Welcome, everybody, to the first day of our Money Matrix Marathon. And we've done a session before where people got a chance to clear their energy and hear about the setup of the program. And right now, what we're going to be doing is having one of our special guest experts. And so I would like to welcome Nanri Twiss for this call. And I'm going to... Hi, Nan.
Hi, Katie.
And I'll just tell you a little bit about Nan before I go into the questions. Nanri Twiss is a graduate of Princeton University and a certified professional life coach. And she is a delightful person, and she loves helping people live happier lives. And in fact, her clients consistently report newfound peace, purpose, and joy, and call her a midwife of meaning and joy, which sounds pretty good to me. So she's currently offering a group coaching program called How to Raise Your Happiness Quotient, or HQ, and Why Your Life Depends on It. She's done all kinds of things in her life, from being a theater director in early adulthood and doing workshops with gang kids in Oakland, California, to help them make the most of their lives. And as an arts educator and an educator, sharing her joy in acting and in Shakespeare's wonders with high school students, and also in Fortune 500 companies, small businesses, nonprofits, and public schools, and even elite private schools and colleges. She's been helping people with communication and leadership skills there. So Nan has been really passionately devoted all her life to helping people improve their sense of meaning and fulfillment in life. And this has taken her throughout the United States and to Europe and to Asia. And Nan now lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and is very happily married with three children aged 11, 13, and 15, which I imagine keeps her very busy. I have no idea how Nan does all she does, because she's very active in not just in her coaching, but in different groups. And like I'm sure many of the listeners to the call, she's into really good foods and supports local organic farms wherever possible. In fact, she formed a co-op which now has more than 300 families, bringing its members together with local farmers who provide grass-fed meat and other products. So really interesting woman we have here, an expert on happiness, and I'm sure Nan could tell us lots more about her life. It sounds really fascinating. But what I would like to focus on, Nan, is if you could tell us a little bit more what led you to research and focus your coaching programs on increasing people's happiness.
I would be delighted to, Katie, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm delighted to be here. You know, I guess I'd start by answering that by, I think that life makes a lot more sense when we look back at if we've lived long enough to have a pattern. You know, the patterns often emerge that we couldn't anticipate. And sometimes we get to a point where we realize, wow, all of these different threads, which didn't seem to have anything to do with one another, all are culminating here. And looking back, it looks like this was destiny. I was meant to be here, even though I never could have predicted it. So I guess I would say I've found my sweet spot with this whole interest in happiness. It's definitely a calling, and I can see the seeds of it in everything I did. Whether it was directing or teaching or leading workshops, it all did have to do with increasing the quality of people's lives and meaning and fulfillment. What didn't exist back then was the field of positive psychology. And what also didn't exist back then was the field of coaching. So let me back up. I'll say one other thing. I think most people who have a calling can usually tell what I call a victim to victory story. for example, you know, I used to have this challenge, I suffered from this, and then I discovered this solution, and now I want to share it with you all.
Right.
I don't actually have a victim to victory story because I have not battled with unhappiness in my life. I'm one of those fortunate people who I think was born with a genetic predisposition. So it's not that I was looking for a solution about what makes people happy. What did happen, though, was that as I started coaching, I noticed patterns of thought that a lot of my clients came with that inhibited their ability to achieve happiness. And I noticed some of the same patterns with one of my three children and with my husband. And then I learned about positive psychology, which is, you know, traditionally psychology was the study of how do we help miserable people become less miserable. It was about pathology. And the head of the American Psychological Association about 20 years ago said, why are we not studying happiness? Why don't we study what makes people thrive? So, you know, if you're going to take on the study of chess, you don't study people who do it badly. You study people who
like
are
that.
Really good at it. So as I started to read about the habits of happy people and what is it that makes people happy, I recognized myself that things I just kind of do intuitively. And I was seeing that these were the habits that my clients, or as I say, my husband, who is not an unhappy person, but has battled mild depression, I'd say. And so I was thrilled because as I started to apply what the research has taught us, as I started marrying that with my coaching tools, I just found, my gosh, this works. So basically I'm marrying the best of the coaching tools with some of the latest science from neuroscience and positive psychology, all about what helps people flourish, be fulfilled, and achieve joy. So when I discovered how effective it was, I got really excited and thought, you know what? I don't want to just do this one-on-one with people. I want to actually teach people all that I've learned and share that with as many people as I can. And that's why I decided to develop a group coaching program on it.
Interesting. So, and I guess in some ways it was interesting that you had a child that had more problems with happiness and just being generally happy-go-lucky, as they say, and a husband, was helpful to you.
Yes, and interestingly, Katie,
finding your work, because there was that contrast.
Yes, and it gave me all the more motivation, and I got to experiment motivated totally by love, particularly with our youngest child. And we started, you know, building in routines that are very simple, but daily things that, you know, she is just, I've got to say, so much of a happier child now. There's just no comparison to how she was a few years ago when she was just complaining all the time. And that is not, I wish I could do like a before and after little video of her, because it's dramatic and it's exciting to me.
Mm.
And that feeds my sense of mission.
Yes.
You know, particularly, Katie, because I think that most of us just get kind of bandied around by circumstances in life. And when you learn what research has uncovered in the last couple of decades about how much we really can influence our subjective sense of well-being, our experience.
And so then maybe, Nan, what you could tell us about and is what have social scientists and researchers been discovering about what really makes us happy?
Well, definitely not what you think. There are so many myths and misconceptions about that, starting with the topic of your program, which is money. I mean, so many people believe that, you know, if only I had more money, or if only I had, you know, I'll carry it beyond that, but that's one of the most common misconceptions. In some cases, it's if only I had the right partner, then I'd be happy. If only I had the right house, the right job, the right body. all of these things which actually have stunningly little to do with our experience of happiness. So let's start with wealth and all the things that money can buy. What the research says is that once your basic needs are met, and that's critical, you know, if you go to the really the poverty-stricken countries, yeah, money makes a huge difference at that level. But once your basic needs are met, additional income does very little to raise your sense of satisfaction with life. And if you don't mind my kind of double-clicking on that and really or unpacking it, there's a lot to say about that.
I would love to hear more because
okay.
It's
so,
really important for our listeners.
For this particular topic, yeah. So as I say, money does make a significant difference to the poor, but once you reach a kind of I'll use in our country a middle-class status, it has a greatly diminished effect once you reach there. And I'll give you just some brief statistics that the research has uncovered. Forbes magazine did a study on the 100 wealthiest people, and they're only slightly happier than the average person. That's the 100 wealthiest people in the nation. If you look at how our lives compare to the lives of our parents or grandparents, depending on how old you are, materially, we are way better off than in the 50s. The average person today, their real spending power has more than doubled. Living standards are higher. People live in bigger houses. Healthcare outcomes are better. People live longer. They're better educated. We have more material comforts with microwaves and cell phones and air conditioning and TiVo and high-speed internet. We have twice as many cars. The list goes on. And yet, our happiness has not budged since the 1950s.
Mm.
We are just as happy. We report ourselves to be just as happy. And in some ways, a little less happy because depression is absolutely on the rise. Much higher than back in the 50s. Another one, like job satisfaction, interestingly, does not depend on salary. So having extra money for luxuries does not increase happiness anywhere near as much as enjoying one's job or social network. So when they want to motivate someone, they'll do a much better job of motivating somebody by offering, for example, a shift in responsibilities that would be more meaningful or where the person would be able to express their strengths. Giving someone a promotion, yeah, it's always nice, but we habituate to things. So increase the money, and it really is an ever-moving goalpost. We're happy for a little bit, but then our happiness goes back to where it was. And we want
and
more.
And isn't that the case, just to interrupt you for a moment, isn't that the case with everything that you get? You're really happy for a little while, like about some new toy, and then it becomes just part of the routine.
You're absolutely right, Katie. And that they call that habituation and or the hedonic treadmill. Hedonic, if you think of the word hedonism, having to do with pleasure, that it really is like being on a treadmill because you never get there.
Mm.
And, yeah, we can be, you know, there's no question that our happiness goes up when we get some new toy. But what I'm interested in is sustainable happiness, not like, you know, the pleasure that a piece of chocolate cake will bring you. You know, that's great. Mm. Or that, you know, getting the newest iPhone definitely elevates happiness. But I want to know what's going to make a difference for you in the long run.
And that's actually, I'm going to ask you a little question around that because there's an interesting contrast. Because to create happiness in a regular way, I would assume there's some need for simple pleasures and things that give you, and at the same time, that sometimes actually working, doing things you love, increases your happiness, but it's not like going and taking a bath in beautiful bath salts or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering about the relation between the two.
Well, very interesting question. And There's no question that simple pleasures can kind of accumulate. And in many ways, what does increase our happiness is really being aware when the circumstances for happiness are there. You know, if you see a beautiful flower and you notice it and just keep going, that's very different than, first of all, really taking it in and actually noticing the effect it has on you. And I'll give you an example of that. There's a course called Awakening Joy, which is done every year out of Berkeley. Used to be a 10-month course, now it's a 5-month course. They spend the first month really focusing on your intention. And James Beres, who's a Buddhist and spiritual leader of many decades, he says that that's the most important thing, that starting with the intention of being happy, you get your radar out there so that you notice when you have moments of pleasure or satisfaction or fulfillment, take it in, appreciate it, and I love the expression, what you appreciate appreciates. It's not just a clever phrase. It actually is solidly backed up in neuroscience, that our brains are wired to give more weight to the negative than the positive. So actually we have kind of a distorted view of reality because we tend to ruminate and marinate on the negative things. If someone said something that hurt your feelings, you're going to massage that and be, you're giving it way more weight. But, and actually neuroscientist Rick Hansen says, we Velcro the negative and we Teflon the positive. That's how our brains are. So what we need to do is reverse that. And our brains actually take 20 to 30 seconds to register positive. So we actually have to be very conscious to give it more weight. And the way we do that is by allowing that, being like a sponge, allowing that 20 seconds or 30 seconds. And so those can be the simple pleasures. It might be just having a fabulous bowl of tomato soup and being really mindful of it. And that, over time, absolutely shifts your what I call happiness quotient. Mm-hmm. And actually, Katie, you know, I probably should explain something about when you were asking about what the researchers and scientists have discovered. Some of this might make more sense if I say a little bit more about what we know about what does affect our happiness.
I'd love to hear more about it.
Okay. I should say that it's first of all, it's stunning how bad we are at predicting what will make us happy. And if you want to know more about that, there's a terrific book called Stumbling on Happiness, which is written by Dan Gilbert. He's a professor at Harvard. Or if you want a really simple, digestible form, he's got a 20-minute TED Talk with the same title. But he really goes into why we are so bad at predicting it. And I'll give you some examples. Whether you, let's say, you know, you gain or you lose a romantic partner, you get or don't get a promotion, you pass or don't pass a test, you win or lose an election, all of those events have way less impact, less intensity, and less duration than people expect them to have. To the point where there's a recent study that shows major life traumas. Mm-hmm. If they happened over 3 months ago, with just a few exceptions, it has no impact whatsoever on your happiness. If it was 3 months ago. But when you're there at the time, it feels like you've been knocked over. And when you're there, sometimes it can feel like you're never going to be anywhere else. Yeah. I think with unhappiness, you really do lose perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do know, well, basically the reason is that happiness can be synthesized. And that is a little bit more complicated than I can really explain in this call, but what we do know is that 50% of our experience of happiness is genetically determined. And they do this by twin studies, you know, looking at identical and fraternal twins. So 50% is from genetics.
Can I just interrupt you there, Nan?
Please.
How do
please.
They define scientifically what happiness is?
Oh, what a wonderful question. Yeah.
I just realized with science,
yes.
It's hard to tell sometimes.
Yes, there are several different ways. Clearly, I'll mention three of them. One is they'll give people surveys because it's a subjective thing. You know, how happy are you with your life right now? So they'll ask the person to evaluate their life in different ways.
Yeah.
What they've found is that actually they get a more realistic picture when they ask people throughout the day, because we're not very realistic in our own appraisal when we're looking at a bigger time.
Yeah.
So someone might say, you know, I'm very happy. But then if you look at their life moment to moment, you won't get the same answers. So they'll have little buzzers that stop them throughout the day. So those are two different versions. And then the exciting thing is, with all the new stuff coming out in neuroscience, they actually have mapped exactly where in the brain one experiences happiness. And so they can put little electrodes on and find out, and they can measure someone's experience of happiness in addition to the way they report it. They can measure their brains before and after an intervention. So, for example, test a group of people's level of happiness and have a control group, and then with the group they're studying, do something simple like arrange for them to find money on the ground, something like that, and then measure later. Or a really interesting one is like give a group of people money, and there's one where they gave $20 to a lot of people. They divided it in half. So one group, they said, go spend this money on yourself today. And some people went to a movie or, you know, went to a restaurant or, you know, had a manicure, whatever. And the other group, they said, same thing, $20, go spend this on somebody else. Yeah. And they measure with the brains and with people self-reporting. And the people who spent the money on someone else, their happiness not only went higher, but it lasted a lot longer. And then there's also the added benefit that the person they spent it on, their happiness went up.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so those are some examples.
And it's almost actually something that goes against what seems to be said in our culture, which has a lot of emphasis on rewarding yourself and making yourself feel good.
Well, and I don't want to put that down because I find it fascinating that generosity and kindness elevates one. I mean, I love that.
Yeah.
that raises your happiness more than indulging yourself. But I also don't want to minimize the importance of cultivating one's own happiness in, you know, we started talking about little pleasures, that it's easy for people to think that focusing on your own happiness is selfish.
Yeah.
But there, you know, here was one example of how you're raising your happiness in exactly the opposite way of being selfish. But also, when your happiness goes up, it radiates around you. They find that when somebody's happiness increases, it also increases the happiness of their friends, their family, their colleagues, and you can go one and even two steps removed to people that they don't even know, which is so cool. And, you know, when you think about it for yourself, like who do you benefit from being around? Is it how does it make you feel to be around somebody who's joyful?
definitely a lot better.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's actually interesting because I'm going to talk about women, because I think they've been trained to be very generous and giving, and yet when they don't give enough, they get really grouchy.
Yes.
And so it's really, and they're not able to radiate happiness. So I think particularly with women, but also with many men, it's just being able to really treat yourself well is going to make you be able to treat other people well too.
Well, there's that saying, ain't when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
That's right.
It's true. Yeah, so actually that's been kind of a challenge for me, being both female and a mother, and I am kind of by nature a nurturing person, but when I do get frustrated, and make no mistakes, I do, it's exactly what you're talking about, Katie. It's when I've been giving, and then I'm depleted.
Yeah.
And then I don't like who I am as a mom or as a wife. And I get, you know, so it is really important to fill your own well. And I don't know about your listeners, but I don't think this is uncommon. For me, a lot of it is about learning to draw boundaries. You know, we live in a time with so much information and opportunities, and if you're somebody who can see possibilities everywhere, you can drown. Mm-hmm. And it's like being a sailboat out on a body of water where it's the strength of the wind and the direction of the wind and the size of the waves which kind of knock you around. And if you haven't learned to really figure out what is important to me and am I taking the time to devote to those things, you know, you'll just be, quote, you know, lost at sea. And you do drown. I do if I lose sight of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because we do actually have societies that are there's so much abundance. There's so many possibilities that in some ways it makes life a lot more complex and to make choices and to say no. And so it's actually requiring something very sophisticated in terms of us figuring out what we really need and what really feeds us and what's most important. And it's at a much greater level than maybe years ago when the choices simply weren't there.
Well, and simply, that's the thing. It is so much more complex. It was simpler then. And when you talk about saying no, I mean, that's been a real hard one for me. I've, you know, getting caught up, whether it's possibility, saying no to myself, like, because I can get overwhelmed with all the things I get excited about and want to do, and learning to say no to other people, which is hard because, I've often thought, well, if somebody has a need and I can fulfill it, why wouldn't I? Of course I would. But then your life is all about being in reaction to. And I think that's how it's easy to lose a sense of purpose. And I would say what you're here on this planet to do. I have an image of like being a pinball in a pinball machine. You're just bouncing off things. And it's the walls and the bumpers and whatever that's determining what direction you're going to go. And that's, again, when I think you feel lost and frustrated. So for me, I've had to make some very hard choices consciously about how I spend my time and learning that focus. So going back to that intention of happiness, that when you're clear about your intentions, then you can map out the actions that will support that. And
that's so true. And so maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what are there any other big challenges you've had in keeping happy every day, and what steps have you taken to increase your happiness levels?
You know, what's been really helpful for me is actually hiring a coach. And I know some people are surprised to hear that a coach would hire a coach, but every really successful coach I know has done that because you get the value of having somebody help you gain clarity and challenging you to focus on what's most important and tweaking what's working and what's not and having the accountability. So my coach has really helped me with that piece in particular of boundaries and saying no. And saying no, there's some great stuff actually about how to say no in a way that is authentic and loving and far more kind, really, than saying yes when you don't want to, in your heart of hearts. But so working with a coach has been great. I would add that I have tons of resources, but one of them is Peter Bregman, who wrote a book called 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distractions, and Get the Right Things Done. That's been really helpful for me. So being clear on what's important, what brings me satisfaction, meaning, and joy can help tremendously has helped me tremendously in decision-making and on how I spend my time. And I would say how I spend my happiness, which is, you know, that may be an odd way to say it, but we can get into that when we talk about happiness as a currency. And the last thing I would say, kind of a no-brainer, but it's impressive what a difference it makes. I have been just so determined to get my adequate sleep and to get my exercise because those are easy to let fall off the radar. And once I determined I was absolutely going to be in bed by 10 and lights out by 10:30 and moving my body, it doesn't have to be rigorous exercise, but just walking, moving my body a lot, standing up rather than sitting down. I'm standing now as I talk to you. I always do that. So little things like that actually, they pay big dividends, since we're talking about money.
Yes. And actually, so I'm wondering, like the social scientists and researchers, what are they discovering about what really makes us happy in the sense of, I mean, I guess exercise and sleep are important there. And what else?
Well, you know, I think I never finished when I was talking about what the research has shown that 50% is genetics. Circumstances, which is where all of us put all of our energy, you know, such as getting the right income and the right, you know, blah, 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 the list I've already made, that's only 10%, which I think
not
is
very much.
Not
very
much. And I'm talking about even extremes like winning the lottery or becoming paraplegic. There are great studies about that and how that affects people's happiness. Hugely in the beginning, and 2 years later, they're kind of back where they were. And so that 50% that's genetic is kind of like a set point, the way, you know, your body temperature or your weight may go up and down, but you tend to return to something, the newness wears off. So, but that 40% that's left, which is up to you, that's when you practice those things I was talking, and I haven't gone into specifics yet, but when you start practicing the habits that happy people engage in, that raises your set point so that you're not stuck. And that's what gives me juice is sharing about that. So what are some of those things? I could talk for hours about it, but in terms of simple things, as I say, start with the intention, and there are several ways to think about that. One is kind of catch yourself in moments of joy or engagement or finding something meaningful, but particularly when you notice a sense of well-being. Notice that and give it time, in a sense, to Velcro that. And what you want to do is get to a point where you have three positive emotions to every negative, because that's how much it takes to balance the huge impact of the negative. So give it that time. Allow the 20 seconds. So for example, Katie, if you complimented me on something, yeah, the typical response would be to say, oh, thanks, and move on.
Exactly.
And or, really,
no, I'm not really good.
Exactly.
This is my mother's British background.
Right. Here's why you're wrong about the compliment you just gave me. And Katie, can you make one up on the spot? Doesn't have to be real, but compliment me about something.
Of course I could. Nan, you are incredibly bright and great at synthesizing research.
Oh, my gosh, Katie. I can't believe you say that, because there's so much I have that I haven't even digested, and I can go on. Now, how does that make you feel if I swat your compliment away like a fly?
Not very good. I feel like, oh, I shouldn't have done it, like I've almost done something wrong.
Right. So that has not been kind to you, and it actually is a missed opportunity for both of us. Yeah. I didn't absorb it, so I'm not going to benefit, and I didn't give you the chance to really be heard and feel the benefit of the kindness you've done. So how do I do that in a way that would allow me to soak it in and take that 20 to 30 seconds so it actually has an effect? Mm-hmm. I can either invite you to do that for me. I might say, oh, that's so nice of you, Katie. What makes you say that? What did I do that made you say that?
Yeah.
And then you can do it for me. and that, how does that feel if somebody really queries you about a compliment you've given?
Oh, it makes me feel heard and also interested in continuing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it also enhances our relationship, which is hugely, that's the one common denominator that shows up with all happy people is deep connection with other people, meaningful relationships. So another way I could do it is I could take that 20 seconds myself or 30 seconds and say, oh, Katie, that makes me feel so good that you say that, because let me tell you what I've been doing. I went out and I've been interviewing people, and I've been exploring things on the web, and I've been attending courses, and I've been, reading books. And so it really feels good to hear that is affecting you in that way, or something like that.
Mm.
So what I'm saying there, the point here is setting the intention, catching yourself in when there's a positive emotion available, and making sure you give the full 20, 30 seconds, and try to go for 3-1.
And that's another habit. I mean, it's really simple, but I can imagine that would have a big impact on your life. And just while because you will be telling us more habits, I'm wondering if you could make any suggestion about how to go about getting these habits in the first place.
Sure.
Try them all at the same time, or go gently?
Well, there is no one ingredient that contributes to happiness, unless you're going to talk about relationships perhaps. But really, it's like there are a lot of different ingredients, and you pick and you choose, find which ones work for you, and go with it. But the important thing is, intentions guide our actions, and you've got to stay, it's the consistency over time. You're not going to change your HQ, your happiness quotient, overnight. However, if you engage in some of the things I'm going to tell you about, studies actually show it showing up in your brain in like 6 to 8 weeks in a way that actually lasts. And the more you do it over time, the more it builds. Mm. So it's like, drops of water, but it's really maintaining that commitment. Like, why, how committed are you to living a more satisfying, joyful life? If you're committed to it, you absolutely can get closer.
Yeah.
So Meditation is another one. Now, that will work for, I mean, it can work for everybody, but that'll be a fit for some, and for others it may not be, and for some it may not have been in the past, but it is now, or and they may not even know it yet. Or, but even if you just take 5 minutes a day, there's some, I don't know if your listeners have heard of Matthieu Ricard, who's a French Buddhist monk, and he's worked very closely with the Dalai Lama, and he's been on the cover of Time magazine. They've studied his brain, and they study it when he meditates, and I think the cover of Time called him the happiest man in the world, because his, but this is after decades of meditating. But even, again, after, like in John Kabat-Zinn's stress reduction classes that are done all over the nation, 8-week mindfulness I think they're called mindfulness classes. And the research is really exciting about the people who attend that and do the practices, that it has lasting effect. So there's that. Gratitude, here's an exercise I do with my daughter. It takes 3 minutes a day that I just ask her at the end of the day to review her day and tell me what the roses were. And I've got in my mind that ratio of 3 to 1. I ask her her roses and her thorns. And when we first started this practice, she didn't have many roses and she had a lot of thorns. Now, she rarely mentions a thorn. Now, that doesn't mean she doesn't have moments of frustration or unhappiness. What it means is she is training her brain to look for what's right, where most of us look for what's wrong. Yeah. And so she, even when something bad happens, she has learned, without my doing anything other than asking her about roses and thorns at the end of the day, over the years, and I'm talking 2 years in her case, she now, even when something devastating happens, like her guinea pig died, and she was, oh, so sad, and she said to me at the time, I know what, you know, there aren't going to be any roses tonight, and I know what the thorn's going to be. Well, that night when I asked her roses and thorns, she never even mentioned the thorn. She had learned instinctively now to turn it around to find what was good about it. She listed one after the other, 7 roses. Well, Twilight had a really wonderful life with us, and Twilight died in my arms, and Twilight, you know, and we gave Twilight a wonderful birthday. So it was all... She'd learned how to reframe. It's not that it's any less true. It's not denial. But it's learning how to appreciate. So that's a simple practice. Just reviewing your day. For some people, reviewing once a week is more effective. Mm-hmm. Expressing gratitude to other people. It raises both people's happiness. So you know what I would say, Katie, is there's so much out there. If you enjoy... learn about the habits of happy people and experiment with them, because I could give you many interventions that they've found to work. It's just a question of trying and trying and try one and then another. And you know, what I would say definitely don't do is don't be measuring all the time. Don't be like checking your scorecard. How happy am I? Am I there yet? Am I there yet? Yeah. Just, you know, that'll ruin it. If you're searching after happiness in that way, you're going to destroy your chances.
And also, I mean, you just said is that you have to look for what habits will increase your happiness, and it is different for different people. And I actually noticed one time I was doing a workshop, and we were talking about having fun. Mm-hmm. And most of us had these ideas in our head about what should be fun for us from life experience or what we've been told. And there were other things we really loved, but we didn't think it qualified as fun, the right fun things. So people have all these things in their heads about what's supposed to be fun, what's supposed to make them happy.
Yes.
And it's kind of getting rid of all those shoulds and really experimenting, as you say, with these different things.
Oh, well, Katie, I'm glad you said that, because there is no happiness killer like judgment. Yeah. Judging yourself, judging others. The shame and blame game can come in there, too. Those kill happiness. Yeah. And so what you're talking about is, well, this is supposed to make me happy, and this isn't. If the judgment, it just trips us up.
Exactly. Oh, I got so many more questions, and I do want to get the audience to, or at least a possibility for people to ask. But let me see. I would like to just flip over a little bit into this role of, like you said earlier, that the social scientists found that having a higher income didn't really raise one's happiness. And I'm just wondering, on the other side, is there any way that money can buy happiness, and in what ways?
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that question. Yes, money can raise your happiness depending on how you spend it. So when, as we talked about before, spending it on things, unless it's something you really need, yeah, it'll lift your happiness and then it'll put it right back where it was. But when you spend it on experiences, you make much more, you get much more return for your buck. also, when you spend it, and this goes back to the pleasure question, that the research says that when you spend money on many small pleasures rather than a few big ones, that you get more return. Now, this one surprised me a little bit because I tend to think of, you know, saving money for the big stuff, but I realize that's, and I get a lot of pleasure from that. I realize that's because we save our money when it's a big thing, it's an experience. So then we get all sorts of things because we get the anticipation of planning it. It's very much relationship focused because it'll be either with my husband or our whole family. So the vacations could be an exception to that, but so also when it's spent on what they call need-satisfying activities, like things that will raise your confidence or things that will increase your relatedness with other people, or in some cases, autonomy. So it may be learning a skill that allows you to be more independent. So that's three. Four, I would say, is when you spend money on other people, not yourself. I've already discussed that. And when you spend money to give you time. So, for example, you might hire a bookkeeper, or you might hire someone to clean your house, things that you don't get value out of. To hire someone else to do it, that is a way to get to raise your happiness by using your money. And also, this is a funny one because there's so much out there which is like, buy now, pay later.
Yeah.
Well, that is exactly the wrong way to do it. Because if you think about habituating, you get something and it raises your happiness for a little while and then you get used to it. Well, you're going to be paying for it when you no longer are getting pleasure out of it. Bad idea. So much better to pay now and then get it later, such as a vacation or, you know, set that reservation at a restaurant. Don't be like, would you rather... Which do you think would bring you more joy? If someone said, okay, tonight you get to go out to this fabulous restaurant, or you're going to get to go to this fabulous restaurant 3 weeks from now.
3 weeks from now?
Yeah. That's what the research says, is you're going to get far more pleasure that way. You get to talk about it. You get to anticipate it. So don't buy now, pay later. Pay now and... and enjoy it later.
Yeah, and actually, if you think about it, things aren't really set up that well in this society to do that. There's all sorts of enticements to do the opposite. Are there any way? How would you go about making sure? Like, I know you could put it in the bank or something, but are there other ways that they've found to do this?
Well, as I was saying, something where you can anticipate the pleasure. So that's why I say, if you're, and it may not even be paying now, but, if you're going to go on a vacation, you're going to have to pay up front.
Yeah.
The point is that you're cashing in down the road.
Okay.
Maybe the difference between ordering something online as opposed to picking it up, I don't know, but I believe in buying from local stores, so I'm not sure I'm going to recommend that.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Katie, happiness, you know, you were asking, mm-hmm. can money buy happiness?
Yeah.
And truthfully, happiness is far more likely to bring you money than the money is likely to bring you happiness. And if your listeners want to pursue that, Sean Aker, who's another Harvard professor, he's got a great TED Talk on that called The Happiness Advantage. And it's basically right. that it's not that success leads to wealth. I mean, it's not that wealth leads to happiness, but happiness actually leads to wealth.
And yes, and I know some of our other speakers are going to be talking a bit about how feeling good actually does increase your attraction factor as far as wealth goes. But I'd love to hear your angle more on that.
Well, say more, Katie. What are you thinking?
Well, I assume when you're happy, for example, I mean, mm-hmm. I know, like, somebody who's happy and in a position works better. They have, they're in a, let's say, at a job
mm-hmm.
That they're happy in. They're going to serve people better. They're probably going to get advances because they have because they're doing a good job. They're going to have better connections with people, which is always helpful in terms of advancement and career. I mean, those are some of the most obvious practical ways I can think of.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm wondering what Sean Aker says, or what you would think about that.
Well, it's absolutely true that the research shows that happy people make more money, they're more likely to be promoted, and they're not focused on the money, but the money. I mean, I don't want to say it's do what you love and the money will follow. That's
yeah.
you know that's another point. Subject, but. If you can increase, here's one of the things. When you become happier, actually your brain is far more open to possibility. And when you are not happy, I've got my arms out right now. It's like closing in. And so people are far more creative when they're happy.
Yeah.
They make decisions much more accurately. Let me give you an example. Like, for example, doctors do much more accurate diagnoses when they're happy.
Huh.
And people perform much better. As a matter of fact, here's an example of how you can use this practically. If you're going to have surgery, and it can be very small, bring a little gift of chocolates to your surgeon the day before. And the studies show he or she will perform a better surgery. So
inexpensive way to ensure better results.
Yeah. So you know, you've got a very creative audience. So here's a huge incentive to raise your happiness if it's not just a sense of, ooh, I want to be happier. But, boy, the creativity. People solve problems. And again, these are all done scientifically where they'll take two groups and they'll do something small to increase one group's happiness. Even like, you know, stumbling upon a dime, something that small. And then they give both groups a problem to solve. And the groups that had some minor happiness booster do far better at the problem solving. So, of course, you're going to perform better and all of those things we've talked about.
Yeah, and it's funny, Nan, just to get into that a tiny bit, is that the predominant myth is that creative people are there's a predominant myth that creative people are somehow more unhappy, you know, like the great mm-hmm. artists were unhappy, and that's the source of their genius. And actually, mm-hmm. there have been studies to show that's not the case at all.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, boy, I spent a lot of time in the theater world, and that was a big one there, too. And I know people who have battled depression and mm-hmm. Didn't want to take medication because they were afraid that it would take away. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying whether they should have or shouldn't have, but it was interesting hearing over and over again from different people their rationale for not taking medication because they were afraid if they became happier, they would lose their creative edge, which is really
yes.
backwards.
So actually, now I would love to end here a little bit about the program you're offering on happiness and how people and what you do in that program.
Well, thank you for asking. It's called How to Raise Your HQ, Happiness Quotient, and Why Your Life Depends on It. And basically, what people get, I mean, I could go over a lot of benefits. The benefit you get from doing this is a big increase in energy and a deeper connection with other people and reducing stress, gaining clarity so you can focus on what matters to you, an increase in sense of purpose and accomplishment and belonging and habits that reinforce your happiness. So what I do is alternate between education and practice. So I offer online trainings that you can look at and listen to you in your own home, where I'll educate you about different parts of happiness, and that happens every other week. And then on the alternate weeks, we meet as a group for a group coaching session where we look at how people are doing with applying what it is that I've trained them in, that I've taught them about the research, how they're doing in applying it, and where they're getting stuck, and they learn a lot from each other. So I think groups are a very powerful way to make change. You really get to multiply the resources, and often people recognize themselves in other people's stories. And so it's 3 months of the live group coaching calls and alternated with the trainings. I also start with an assessment. So the participants start with an assessment and then end. So I call that, start where you are and see where you end. And it's a fabulous assessment that I use with all of my clients. And it looks at your perceptions, beliefs, the things that determine the filter that you're seeing life through, and how they affect your well-being. And then at the end, and I've never had somebody take it the second time where they hadn't significantly raised their number. So, and then there's also an online community where an online forum where people can communicate with each other, and those who want to can also get accountability buddies to stay in touch with between sessions. And so that's the program.
Well, that sounds marvelous. Yeah, must be a happy group. And
well, no, that's the thing. It's not a happy group. The people who, these are people who feel like happiness has kind of eluded them.
Okay.
But they support each other, and what it is a group, and I'm not saying it's a depressed group either, but these tend to be fairly, high-functioning people. This is definitely not therapy. But as they learn more and start applying the practices, it's exciting as people start to realize, oh, my gosh, I have far more influence over my happiness than I knew, and this is working. And so they get to share that journey, and that is fun and exciting and joyful.
Yes. And so, well, man, that sounds very, very lovely, that program. And I'm wondering, can you just give the website or where they would go to find out more about it?
Sure. I think the best way is probably for people to attend a free webinar that I offer. And in that webinar, I go into more detail. But the webinar is called Be Unreasonably Happy: How to Experience Well-Being No Matter What, and it's giving a lot of really great tips about happiness. And you can attend that, and then if you're interested, I can show you how to sign up for the program and give you the dates and the costs and all that. And you can get there by going to www.coachforhire.com. And the four is the word F-O-R, it's not the number, and hire is H-I-G-H-E-R, so opposite of lower. So all run together, coachforhire.com. And you can sign up.
Wonderful. So I'm just going to open up and see if there's any questions. And I certainly have more, but I'd love to hear from our audience. So I'm going to open up and the lines, and if anybody would like to ask a question, just please say something right away. Okay, I'll wait another minute or two.
And Katie, while people are thinking of questions, I would also love to share something that's really exciting to me. You know, I work with individuals and small groups, but this research has been so so impressive that nations are now looking at, including the U.S., looking at, instead of measuring GDP, and I know we're never going to stop measuring that, but measuring happiness. So Bhutan started this quite a while ago. They decided to measure prosperity by gauging its citizens' happiness levels and not the GDP. And other nations that are, and they've discussed this at the UN, and let's see, the US, the UK, Brazil, Australia, France, Canada, China, they're all looking at measuring well-being in a way to look at a national happiness index. And I'd love to share a quote from the Prime Minister of Bhutan, whose idea this was. He says, "The time has come for global action to build a new world economic system that is no longer based on the illusion that limitless growth is possible on our precious and finite planet, or that endless material gain promotes well-being. Instead, it will be a system that promotes harmony and respect for nature and each other, that respects our ancient wisdom and traditions, that protects our most vulnerable people as our own family, and that gives us time to live and enjoy our lives and to appreciate rather than destroy our world. It will be an economic system, in short, that is fully sustainable and that is rooted in true, abiding well-being and happiness."
I love that. You could post that on our Facebook group or give it to me and I'll post it.
Sure.
There. That's beautiful.
Sure. And that's kind of one of the reasons I talk about making happiness your ultimate currency is that we tend to think of trading money for things. That's the currency we speak of. And we want more of it, and we think the more of it we have, the happier we'll be. Well, you know, most of us, if we look at how many of us want more money, almost everyone will say yes. Why do you want more money? What would you do with more money that you cannot do now? And why is that important to you? Why do you want that? And why do you want that? And when you pursue that, ultimately, all roads lead to happiness. And the Dalai Lama says that is the point of life, happiness. Yeah. You know, the world's number one spiritual leader. So it's not a petty, selfish thing. It's a very important thing.
Well, before I ask another question, because I do have another question here, I'm going to see once again whether there's anybody in the audience who would like to say something. Okay. So I guess we're asking all the questions for them. yes, which is fine. And also, of course, people can post their questions on Facebook later we'll have a discussion about it. And maybe, Nan, you're in our Facebook group. You could pop in and see what people come up with.
Sure. Yeah, sometimes people would rather not ask questions out loud, and that's totally fine. Or they may, some questions may formulate later.
Exactly, because there's a lot of content here. I had a question. Like you've mentioned a number of things that make you happy, and most of them seem like they're pretty well things that you don't have to pay money for. Are there any other simple things you can do to increase your happiness, whatever you have in the bank?
Well, as I say, the most important one is one of the most important ones is noticing it and expanding the moments that you do have. But there are a lot of things, and I mentioned moving your body. Being in nature is a huge one. It's interesting how studies show that people who are in nature are far more generous. They take a group of Berkeley students and happen to wander into a redwood grove or eucalyptus grove, and arrange for someone to come and drop their books. And the students are far more likely to pick them up and help the person, again, which raises happiness on both sides, than if they're on the street. Cool. So some other things. Hold on a second, because I'm going to look at some of the ones that I'll tell you the kind of categories.
Yes, I would love to hear.
So certainly gratitude and mindfulness, learning to be in flow, which is engagement. You know what, rather than go through this list, let me tell you another really high-level one. There's a website you can go to. I'd have to look it up and I can give it to you. But where you can take a simple free assessment called VIA Strengths. And VIA stands for Values in Action. And philosophers and religious leaders and, you know, throughout time have identified the same virtues over and over again: wisdom, kindness, playfulness, curiosity. And these same ones show up in all societies. And so this assessment will tell you kind of rank in order which of those, you could call them strengths or virtues or signature strengths, characters. These are all, you know, we each have our own, I don't know how to put it, but basically this will surface which are the ones that are most important to you. Mm-hmm. So, for example, curiosity is a big one for me, and I think it's one of the reasons I'm like a kid in a pool, you know, playing around with all this research. I love it. I'm just, yeah. You know, so anyway, so once you take this assessment, you can then find ways of using those strengths in situations that are particularly aggravating and turn it around. One story I like to tell is, because this captures it so well, there was a woman who bagged groceries, and she hated her job, but she was living paycheck to paycheck. She didn't see any way that she could quit her job. Well, she learned about this and was given the assignment. Oh, her number one strength was social.
Yes.
So she was given the assignment, how can you use that strength, that value, that virtue? It doesn't mean it's a talent, but it's a value. How can you use that in your job to transform this experience that's so negative into one that's positive? And what she decided to do was make it her goal every day that at least 5 customers would count their interaction with her as the highlight of their day.
Wow.
And overnight, her experience of her job transformed, and she started being joyful at work because she was no longer putting cans into a bag. What she was doing was engaging people in a way that gave her and them pleasure.
Mm.
It reminds me, when I was in college, there was this woman who sorted the mail, and she was always so grumpy. Oh, you know, we'd say, Jennifer, has the mail come? And she just was ugly in her response. And I decided that I was going to see if I could, over time, get her to be nice. And so every time when I asked her, I would always go out of my way to be nice. And I tell you, after about 3 weeks, you know, she became I'm not saying she became a different person, but she interacted with me very differently.
Yeah.
And my youngest is in elementary school, and I'm the elementary school crossing guard this year. And I'm out there helping the kids cross the street, and I'm watching the school buses go by the same route every day, and we always wave to each other. And 3 of the 5 bus drivers, they'll lift their hand, but they rarely smile. And one, this guy has the biggest grin on his face every time. And I've noticed that my reaction to them has changed. Now I just kind of summarily wave to the 3 kind of grumpy bus drivers, and to the guy who grins, I'm like, oh, good to see you. And so he has created his own reality. He has created an environment where I'm giving him this joyful one. Once I noticed that, I started going out of my way to be more joyful to the others. But it was interesting to watch that.
Well, that's a lovely story. And yes, so I just have one final little thing which links in with the other work that we do, is that while you said that 50% is linked with genetics,
mm-hmm.
and that's seen as maybe something that's not changeable, that 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Now what they're finding with energy medicine and energy psychology is that you can, and Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's a scientist.
Biology of belief.
Exactly. Is
yeah.
showing that you can have an impact on your on the biology, on the genetics. And a lot of genetic things which are passed down are probably also passed down due to trauma, which energy medicine can clear. And so I think there's some very interesting things that can happen in terms of not not seeing genetics as something that the actual genetic component of things as not being changeable.
Yeah, there's some exciting...
It may be that you can't completely transform certain things, but you sure can make it a hell of a lot different.
Yeah, there's very exciting and fascinating research on that. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yes, and so, well, Nan, this has been such a pleasure, and I'd love to do your happiness course because it just sounds so beautiful. I'm sure some other people who'll be listening to that will feel compelled.
Mm.
I know just to say things is that I think I've got an optimistic point of view when I'm not depressed. But I actually was born in a family where my mother was pretty even keel and my father wasn't. And so he'd be either really happy one day or, you know, pretty grumpy another day. And I've basically inherited that.
Mm.
And I found, though, over the years and using energy medicine and different things that's definitely been changed a lot.
Mm.
But I still can't, I'm still not even keel like my brother or my mother. And so it's something you live with. And also I think maybe sometimes the fact that you, and we were talking about artists, some artists are more up and down and are more sensitive to things. And so, but that is not a curse. And then there's also the capacity to really experience and, you know, find a lot of happiness in life, even though one has this, you know, predisposition to ups and downs.
Well, and I truly believe, and the research backs this up, that you can get to a place where you are happy no matter what, and you're not at the mercy of the things that happen around you. Now, that doesn't mean happy smiley face all the time, but it does mean being able to really experience all that life has to offer without losing your balance, and that includes grief and sadness and anger and frustration, but you don't have to get stuck there. That as you learn to really practice a lot of these habits, your resilience goes up so much so that you don't, you go there and you're not afraid to go there. You really, and I know this sounds so hypothetical, but go read the research. So, Katie, this has been a total pleasure for me. I always love talking with you, and those who have signed up with your program, I have no doubt are in for real substantive benefit. And knowing you, you're going to make it fun too.
Thank you. And Nan, yeah, it's been so good. What I would love you to do, though, is to repeat again your website address so that people can scribble it down and go there right now.
Sure. www.coachforhiger.com. www.coachforhire.com. And I think even if you misspell it, it'll take you to me.
Yes, and I'll be putting it up too in our resource section.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So thanks again to Nan for such a wonderful, wonderful presentation of some of the things they're discovering in science and things we can do to change our happiness level. And actually, we'll be taking some of the things that she's saying and repeating them and bringing them into our daily calls because they're excellent habits, and I would love people to be able to really take advantage of them and start doing things. We're in each of our daily sessions, we're going to be talking about habits, and one of them is gratitude, and I think Nan has just added another angle to why gratitude is important and how to increase it. So thank you once again, and have a wonderful and a very happy day.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you so much. You too, and to all your listeners. And I should also add, if anyone wants to contact me directly, there is a form on that website, or you could just email me at nan@coachforhire.com.
Fantastic.
So everybody have a blast with Katie for the next 10 days.
Yes, we will.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.